Hello everyone and welcome to the latest Brewin podcast, and in a week where news flow has been dominated by Brexit, we attempt to keep you abreast of other arguably more important matters, certainly as it pertains to the stock market. Our focus is on US and Chinese policy, and we're sure you'll enjoy the debate. But first, please listen to our disclaimers.
The value of investments can fall and you may get back less than you invested. Past performance is not a reliable guide to future performance. The podcast is not intended as investment advice. No investment is suitable in all cases. Any tax allowances or thresholds mentioned are based on personal circumstances and current legislation, which may change. We or a connected party may have an interest in the securities mentioned or may act as principal or agent in those securities from time to time. The podcast content comes from diverse sources whose accuracy cannot be assured. The opinions expressed in this publication are not necessarily held throughout Brewin Dolphin. Investment in currencies other than your own means changes in the exchange rate will cause the value of your investment to move independently of the underlying asset.
Hello everyone and welcome to the latest Brewin podcast. I'm Ben Gutteridge, Research Director here at Brewin Dolphin, and today we're going to take a geopolitical focus, and we're going to do that with BCA's Chief Geopolitical Strategist, Matt Gherkin. We're delighted to have Matt joining us on the line from Canada. We'll say hello to him in a moment, but just to give everyone an idea of what we're talking about, it's important to stress that actually we're going to avoid, where possible, the subject of Brexit, certainly in any detail, given we're aware that we did a Brexit podcast last week and you'll be, bombarded by Brexit developments. Obviously, Matt has very useful things to say on that, and we incorporate that in our own research here at Brewin Dolphin. But as I said, we'll avoid it today for fear of you drowning in Brexit material. Instead, we're going to look at US foreign policy, looking at how they're managing the trade relationship with China, which I guess is the key issue for markets at the moment, but also how they're managing relationships with Iran, which is again another bubbling concern. And then perhaps we'll round out with a look at how domestic policy is unfolding and what are the prospects for not only the various contenders in the Democrat Party race, but also their prospects for, I guess, victory come next November. So a very long introduction. Thanks for sticking with us. Matt, thanks so much for joining us on the line from Canada. We're really sort of keen to kick off to get your take really on the US-China trading relationship, where we are. I know it's a very open question, but what are the motivations of each side, and how this may yet drag on?
Great. Well, I'm very pleased to be here. I think that at the moment we're witnessing a high degree of negative momentum in the U.S.-China trade tensions. And that stems from the fact that the G20 summit in Japan in Osaka was basically a flop. The two sides did not have a joint statement. They didn't publicly agree on the same takeaways. They then didn't follow through on what the two sides said would be their takeaways. And the July round of negotiations in Shanghai were unproductive. So as a result, we entered August with President Trump angry at the lack of progress, angry that his advisors were not able to ensure that commodity purchases in particular would be going up from China. And so on August 1st, he raised the tariff, threatened that he would do that. And then subsequently, we saw an additional escalation later in the month. And that has left us now with a projected a hike on tariffs that's occurred on September 1st, a projected hike on October 1st and December 15th. And when all is said and done by December 15th, that means that all Chinese imports will have tariffs on them, as they now do, but at a rate of 30% for the first half and 15% for the second half. And it's an extraordinary turn in the trade talks, because it shows that President Trump still has a very, very voracious risk appetite. And that's not intuitive, given that he has an election next year and the negative economic repercussions of the trade war are starting to be felt.
Okay, and so in that regard, we're looking at sort of news flow on a daily basis on this. And I guess sort of the overnight news is, well, there hasn't been any date set for September talks. I mean, we want to sort of understand what are the prospects for the various bodies to sort of get round the table, or actually do you always sort of come back to the longer term themes of technological transfer and the improbableness of a deal getting done?
Yeah, I think in the very near term, we should expect more negative surprises. And again, that's kind of what I mean when I say that the momentum is going in the wrong direction. That's because these September talks, they've been slated since July. They could fall apart. That would be received very poorly by the global equity market. Also, you could have no prospect for meetings or agreement or discussion among the leaders at the United Nations General Assembly in late September. October 1st is China's National Day, which will be a very nationalist outpouring of sentiment. They'll have a large military parade, etc. And in the advance of that celebration, 70th anniversary of the regime of the People's Republic of China, there will be a very tight environment in terms of the way that media is controlled and the way that discussions are allowed to take place regarding the U.S. So it's not a time frame for China to come out and be conciliatory or offer any new concessions, not at all. And in addition, we have China asserting that it has the right to declare an emergency. Obviously, it has this right and intervene in Hong Kong. And that could involve the use of mainland security forces in Hong Kong, which would almost certainly result in civilian casualties. And if that should occur, it would greatly reduce the probability of a U.S.-China trade agreement. So over the near term, we have a lot of landmines in the way. But after October 1st, there's some possibility that there could be a thaw and things could improve on the margin.
Okay, well, let's look at that. I guess we want to consider the consequences for the respective parties of not getting around the table sooner and not striking a deal. You've talked about President Trump's re-election chances. Perhaps we could come back to that, or perhaps that sort of covered it off neatly. But I guess we'd be interested to know, you know, what are the consequences of China not yielding on these negotiations? And therefore, I guess, what are some of the motivations for them to get a deal done?
Yeah, for China, you do have economic constraints as well. It's just that they're not on that very near-term time horizon that President Trump is operating on, with November 2020 being kind of the moment of truth for him. China is concerned about rising unemployment. Unemployment is really the bottom line for the Communist Party. It's very difficult for a Communist Party under any of the Chinese leaders in modern history to allow a high level of unemployment. And that will occur if large sections of the manufacturing sector are rendered, excess capacity due to a lack of trade competitiveness with the United States. And more broadly, we've seen that the way the tariffs really work is that they harm sentiment, and therefore you get a global slowdown in trade and manufacturing that really is in excess of the strict magnitude of the tariffs. And so this is a risk, and this is a problem for President Xi Jinping. Since he has removed term limits, he's going to be around for many, many years. And in that sense, he will ultimately have to face the consequences if he allows a disruptive and destabilizing transition in the manufacturing sector.
But it doesn't.
And so that puts a limit.
But doesn't that sort of offer a handy excuse for President Xi to sort of blame it on the sort of Western, you know, to blame it on the United States and allow them to move towards a more sort of domestic service-based economy transition with a natural level of job losses in any such process, that he could just sort of blame at the U.S. door?
Yeah, that's true. That's actually a very very well articulated point there. President Vladimir Putin of Russia did something similar. Once he was put under Western sanctions, he enacted domestic reforms that were extremely painful, and he was able to use the West as a foil so that he could then have a scapegoat. He could blame the West and then get these things done at home that otherwise were difficult to do. And we have some evidence that China is doing that. The only thing is that they haven't really been, let's put it this way, they started stimulating the economy more once the trade talks started falling apart and once the tension started escalating. And that was in July of 2018. And we've seen since then that the reaction is typically to add more stimulus as necessary to offset the tariffs. Now, it doesn't mean that they're doing a gigantic stimulus on the order of 2015, 2016, or 2008, 2009. But it does mean that their immediate response is to pump more money and credit into the system in order to make sure that the bottom doesn't fall out from the economy. And broadly speaking, that works against the reform initiative. So I think the easiest way to encapsulate all of this is just to say that Chinese policymaking right now is incoherent. They want to stimulate, but they don't want to re-leverage too much. They want to institute economic model transition and blame President Trump for that. But at the same time, they don't want the slowdown in the economy to be so extreme that the process of economic transition is derailed, and you end up with longer term damage done to the economy and slower potential GDP growth.
Okay, well, I mean, I'm sort of keen to get some sort of predictions, and I know you may ascribe sort of low confidence levels to this and recognize the challenges that come with it. But I mean, given that you've sort of already articulated that Trump's presidential election chances will be damaged by no deal sort of being struck, and China has its own economic challenges and keenness to avoid avoid sort of an economy reliant on more stimulus and more re-leveraging, more debt, you know, there is plenty of reasons why we would hope for a deal. I mean, what is your prediction at this stage, and what are your sort of probabilities?
Yes. So we put it at 40%, the odds of a trade agreement between the U.S. and China by November 2020. So you can see that's kind of a low conviction view that they won't get a deal. But what we've signaled for our readers is, and as you and I are discussing, that this may be in store for an upgrade, particularly, I think, after October 1st, if President Trump stages a retreat and pulls back on the pressure and attempts to resolve a deal with China. I think the big question then becomes Xi Jinping and what will China do? Because they're harder to read. Trump clearly needs to do something where he gets a win, he gets a trade deal, he shows he's the deal maker, improves the economy or removes headwinds, and that can help him in 2020. What about Xi Jinping? Is it worth it for him to accept a capitulation by Trump? Or does he face a much more strategic choice by China, which would be simply to let President Trump suffer and get kicked out of office as a result of the absence of a deal? I think it's within China's power to do that, but I do think it would be overreaching. And so generally speaking, we give the odds at about 40%. We've never put the odds of a deal over 50% at our strategy. Now we're at about 40, but we do change when new information and new evidence come to light. And what we would be looking for is in October and November for Trump to stage a bit of a retreat, and then for Xi Jinping to pick up that olive branch and go ahead and go toward at least a short-term deal. But we fully would expect conflict to reemerge in 2021 and beyond.
Well, I guess in that sort of 60% scenario, I know this is sort of a bit speculative, but just working through some of the things you said there, is that, well, perhaps Trump decides it's in his interest actually to sort of seek a resolution. China doesn't like dealing with Trump and therefore does not sort of is unable or chooses not to strike a deal on whatever terms are laid out. And then Trump is sort of in a bit of a quandary, can't get a deal. And then what's his strategy? One sort of fears that he may just sort of go all, not a metaphor, I hope, but all sort of guns blazing and really sort of creates bottlenecks with Chinese trade.
Right. That's a great point. And that's why, so for instance, he has threatened to use the 1977 International Emergency Economic Powers Act, which would give him much broader authority. It would be a national emergency based on China, theft of U.S. technology and intellectual property, and he'd be able to freeze assets and sanction Chinese banks and halt transactions. It would be more dramatic than tariffs. I think if we're looking at an environment where President Trump cannot save the economy, if we've already gone into a bear market, if we're already going into a recession, if those things transpire and Trump doesn't have a deal, then he may very well have an incentive to escalate the conflict with China and run on the ticket as a war president or a crisis president. That's really his last hope in that environment. But as long as we don't have those conditions met, where we're not witnessing a bear market, the U.S. economy is still holding up, I think we should expect for Trump to make a shift and to try to clinch a deal one last time. And then from China's point of view, I think your point is well taken. Does China fear that allowing Trump to be completely, unraveled? Does that then raise much greater risks for China? And I think the answer is yes. And so that would be another reason why, if Trump does stage this tactical retreat, that China might simply accept that. But I don't think they'll be offering any more concessions than they've already offered.
Okay. And so just to be clear, trying to look at this 60% chance of not striking a deal, are all of those sort of scenarios extremely bad news for markets, or are there some that the markets can deal with?
Yeah, within the 60%, I'd say 40% chances that if they don't get a deal and it's all breaking down during the election year, it's going to get pretty scary. Because as I mentioned, I think that's where President Trump basically runs on the ticket that he's a war president, that we're in a new Cold War, and that China is attempting to gain hegemony in Asia and take over the U.S. technological advantage. So I think that's very bad. I mean, there's some chance, I give it maybe 20% within that 60%, that that they're able to negotiate a kind of ceasefire that really goes nowhere, but it's short of a deal, but it's also preventing excess escalation in the conflict. That's harder to do because then Trump basically has nothing to run on. He doesn't have a trade agreement to run on in the campaign, but he also doesn't have a Cold War to run on in the campaign.
Okay, well, thanks for tying that up. I think we might just move on to a couple of other subjects, if we may. I mean, if we look at U.S. foreign policy in relation to Iran, I mean, when we look at the sort of U.S.-China trade deal, obviously it's having global connotations for sentiment, as you said, but actually, it doesn't. It only affects a relatively sort of small portion of the global economy. But when you think about a conflict or an issue with Iran that, or any other circumstances that lead to a serious surge in the oil price, clearly that would affect all consumers and a far greater number of businesses. So we are concerned about this issue and other issues that may lead to that outcome. I mean, do you see the Iranian tensions, one that could precipitate that outcome?
So Iran is not over. The tensions that we've seen this summer have not really come to a conclusion, and I don't think that they will in time for the November election for President Trump. I don't think he can really get anything positive out of Iran, and I'll tell you why. But I want to connect the two issues by pointing at some similarities between Iran and China. In both cases, neither side wants to set a precedent that basically rewards President Trump, but also sets a precedent for future presidents, that you can behave the way Trump has done with just brute economic coercion and be rewarded for that. So both sides are averse to that. And what that means in China's side, since they're economically exposed and they're also exposed to global trade, is that Trump needs to be the one who stages the retreat and comes crawling back to China, and then maybe they can do a deal. But in Iran's case, there's really very little basis for a deal, because it's extremely difficult for anyone to project that President Trump is going to remove the sanctions. And that doesn't make any sense prior to his election, because it would be a 180-degree reversal of his policy, and he would lose all credibility on the Iranian issue. So if he won't remove the sanctions, then Iran has no incentive to negotiate, because even to engage in negotiations is to confirm President Trump's approach, is to say that Iran is economically vulnerable, that they have no other choice, and therefore the U.S. president can basically bully them around. Instead, what they want to do is highlight the risk and uncertainty and the division with Europe, and the division with the rest of the international community that has resulted from Trump's walking away from the 2015 deal, and leave it at that. And then they will occasionally stage provocative actions, but they'll go short of actually killing, you know, Americans bombing troops in their barracks or anything so radical that it would give Trump a pretext to launch airstrikes.
Or I guess we all sort of focus on this Straits of Hormuz issue. Would they sort of, I guess, they cut their nose off at all to spite Trump's face?
You know, on that front, I think it's probably they're probably really pushing it there. And you've seen that the U.S. and its allies started to galvanize a large fleet, a combined fleet that will then patrol those waters. If it's the case that the U.S. is responding effectively in the Strait of Hormuz, and given how high the risks are for Iran, that there could be airstrikes against them, they may shift and start targeting other assets. And that means, as we've seen, clearly they can provide backing for the Houthi forces in Yemen, but really it has to do with what type of activity they engage in Iraq, because that's where the oil is produced and where you could have Shia militants conduct sabotage that would take oil offline, cause some concern in the global marketplace, send a warning signal to President Trump, but yet still fall short of the level that forces Trump's hand in launching airstrikes.
Okay, fascinating, really fascinating. Okay, and we might sort of round out, if we may, on the US presidential election cycle and who are the front runners in the Democrats, on the Democrat side, and what are the ones that are sort of more market friendly and less so?
Yes, well, so as a top line kind of takeaway, barring recession, we think Trump is slightly favored. So 55% chance Trump gets reelected. That's based on just the historical probability where U.S. presidents, when they run to reelection, they usually get reelected. It's about a 70% reelection rate. And the biggest factor, because Trump is running late in the business cycle, is whether we do start to see rising unemployment and whether we see a bear market or whether any of those things are enough to start seeing this headline of recession become more frequent. And we've gotten a taste of that over the past couple of weeks. If that continues, it really could destroy this president. He's a commercial president. He has no governing or military experience. He has very little to run on aside from his economic record. And as I mentioned, if he's forced to run as a war president, that's very risky for him because that means the economy is definitely going down the drain. So we have to say at this stage, he's slightly favored, but only slightly, less so than normal incumbents. And that's particularly because of his weak polling. He's not a very popular president either. He typically polls at about a 41 or 42% approval rate. So within that 45% chance that the Democrats are able to win, it obviously matters who their candidate is, whether that candidate is electable, and whether that candidate is able to increase the odds of unseating Trump. Former Vice President Joe Biden is definitely the front runner. There have been some polls recently that show him neck and neck with his two closest rivals, Senator Bernie Sanders of Vermont and Senator Elizabeth Warren of Massachusetts, both of whom are progressive or left-wing candidates. But in general, Biden is tracking very well ahead of all the other contenders. And that makes sense. He's got large name recognition. He sat in the Oval Office for 8 years. He's closely associated with President Barack Obama so that he has support within the minority community for that reason. And also, he has full support of the Democratic Party machinery, which is able to get out the vote for the kind of tried and true rank and file of the Democrats. So Biden is the most electable, and he's the front runner.
But would it
and
be
if he extends? Yes.
But I mean, but would it be fair to say that the momentum is with Elizabeth Warren?
I think at this exact moment, she's got a fair amount of momentum, and that's justified. She's done very well in both the debates so far, and she's done so well that I have no hesitancy in saying that in the middle of September, here in 2 weeks, when we go to the third debate, that she'll do well again. And so she may surpass Bernie Sanders and become the number two candidate clearly in the polling after this month and after these debates. And it, of course, it depends on her performance. It depends on Bernie Sanders' performance. And then also, is Joe Biden able to maintain this large lead? But his polling has been remarkably stable as well. So he received a boost that pushed him up into the upper 30% support rate. And then he came back down, but really he's still at around 30% in most polls. And it's pretty firm. It's going to be hard to dislodge him. And it's going to be particularly hard to dislodge him once we get into the real primary, because, of course, that hasn't even started yet. But in these debates, Warren is surging. She's surging because she's a progressive candidate. She's a woman. She has a very aggressive debating style. It makes her hard to deal with for some of these older candidates. I think in the case of Bernie Sanders and Joe Biden, they sometimes have trouble staying on message or dealing with the thrust and parry of the debates. And I think that's probably something that some people would even project forward, saying if Warren is in a debate with President Trump, she'd mop the floor with him because she can move so much more quickly. She's a policy wonk. The problem for Warren is she's really not as electable as either Sanders or Biden. And the reason for that is both Biden and Sanders have a very clear electoral college pathway to the White House, which is through those key Rust Belt states of Wisconsin, Michigan, and Pennsylvania, the blue wall that Trump surprisingly broke in 2016. And those are typically Democratic states. Biden and Sanders both do very well there. And Biden also has the ability to compete in places like Florida and Arizona. So there's a little bit of a difficulty for the progressive candidates once they get outside the Rust Belt. And within the Rust Belt, it looks as if Sanders and Biden are more competitive.
Okay. Well, we'd be delighted to talk to you more about each candidate's and their sort of market friendliness at a later date. But we're out of time now. But thanks so much, Matt, for sparing the time. A really useful update covering all of those areas. And yeah, we'll let you get back to the grind over in Canada. To our listeners, thanks very much for listening. Let us know what you think on Twitter, referencing hashtag Brewing Podcast, or leave a review on iTunes or SoundCloud, whatever platform you listen to us through. But until next time, many thanks for listening.